what I'm helping people do is wake up to deeper truths about themselves, about their behavior patterns, and the stories they've told themselves to keep those patterns alive and justified. Change always comes when those stories get unjustified by reality. And there's nothing like a partner to unjustify you.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Welcome, everybody, to this Facebook Live about how to change. And, you know, a lot of the questions that came in were related to things other than getting stuck in repeating patterns, but I'm going to still teach you some concepts about what creates change and how it's related to evolving in our relationship to ourselves and in our relationship to others, especially in marriage. Before I start in, I just want to tell you all about a few things that are coming up. We posted a date night for February 14th in Alpine, and it's sold out. And so we are doing another date night on Tuesday, the 11th in Layton, Utah. Christy posted that today. It's already about half sold out. But if you're interested in coming to hear me teach for a couple of hours and you live in the Utah area, come see us on February 11th. Christy will put a link there. Also on the 13th of February, I am teaching for people that are engaged or planning to get married or who have just gotten married, that's also in Alpine. No, maybe Provo. Is that in Provo, Christy?
That one is in Provo.
That's
and we
in
have
Provo.
Just about, we have 14 tickets left for that engaged newlywed couple date night.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So just a great starting course on how to think about what we're doing when we get married, how to create a meaningful sexual relationship, how to think about conflict and how to deal with differences. So a lot of times we get married and we are just operating from the wrong idea about what marriage is and what it's going to ask of us. And so the greater clarity we have about that, the better our marriages can be. I should just also, before we start, tell you we have a couples trip to Portugal and also to Switzerland that are coming up. Portugal's in April. Switzerland is in July. It's Switzerland and Austria. If you're interested in that, Christy will post that. We have a Sex Worth Wanting live event in June in Oregon. And then tell me, Christy.
We do have a one-day Art of Desire on February 7th. That's in Alpine, Utah. That is nearly sold out. I'll post a link to everything we talk about here. Like you said, the Sex Worth Wanting retreat in June in Hillsboro, Oregon. We also have an Art of Desire retreat in August in Oregon. That's the more immersive.
The 3-day, 3 to 4 days. It's a more immersive experience in Oregon. And then the men's retreat, Art of Loving, in St. George, Utah in November.
That's right. Yes.
All right. So how do we make sense of our resolutions and our determination to change things? And then, you know, within a few days of the resolution, we forget, or we think, you know, I'll do that later. I was saying to Christy, I have to get off the sugar and the chocolate. So I'm not going to have any chocolate while I'm here with you while we were teaching. And, you know, on day three, I was like, you know what? I was going to have like one piece of chocolate. Okay. So, you know, when we have hit that moment of I need to change, we feel resolved, but then often we fall back into our habitual pattern, or our body's kind of saying we want that chocolate or whatever. And it's easy to just fall back into patterned behavior. And so it's not strange that we find ourselves very often living out the same problematic or limited patterns over and over and over again. And so why does this happen? I think that most of us build an identity, which is a self-concept that solidifies in our early adulthood. And it's a self-concept that often started in childhood. And then once we built this kind of internal story about who we are. Like, what is the predictable pattern that we are going to enact when we respond to our lives, when we respond to choices? And when we keep repeating that same pattern over and over again, that builds our self-concept. And it's not truly like who we are. It's not truly as robust as we might believe, but because it's habitual and we are in a state of equilibrium with ourselves, even if we are very unhappy, we are enacting what we know. We know how to be this limited self. And so it's very easy to stay in the familiar territory of the self we know rather than the self that would make us more happy, the self that would be better at relationships. We all hold our ideals, but the process often of becoming that ideal is to forsake and give up aspects of ourselves that are familiar and known to us. And that process is uncomfortable. And so we are very, very good at avoiding it, at resisting it, at clinging to the familiar, even if miserable, style or pattern that we know how to do. And so how did we build our self-concept? Where does it come from? Certainly our biology plays a role in how we respond to the world and how we respond to the people around us and how they respond to us. And so our biology is definitely a part of our personalities and the ways that we cope in the world. But we also borrow identities that others told us about ourselves. So, you know, as I talk about in the relationship course and strengthening your relationship, and in really most of the courses, is that when we first start out in life, we are borrowing a sense of self from the people around us. And so, you know, when mom says you are capable, that turns into I am capable, right? Or you are lazy turns into I am lazy. You're good at math, I'm good at math. You're too emotional, I'm too emotional, right? You disappoint me, I'm a disappointment. And so even if these concepts that we took from those around us came from the mouths of limited parents and limited caregivers who may have been overwhelmed or unable to see us properly for the divine potential that we embody, the pictures that are nonetheless offered to us can be very, very powerful in defining a self. If my mother didn't love me, then how could I possibly be lovable, right? It's a very, very hard to see outside of that experience because we are so dependent on the minds of the people that were there to take care of us. And so it's very easy to internalize those voices and to live them out without us even realizing that they are borrowed concepts, that they are internalized perceptions. We also grow into a self-concept through the choices that we make, right? So sometimes we make choices out of that concept that we borrowed. Mom says, I'm lazy, therefore I'm going to keep repeating that pattern in my life because that's the self I know how to be. But even if we were raised by loving parents, but we struggle to self-regulate in the world, even if they believed in us, thought the best of us, but we come up against the anxieties of living and adulthood and we recoil from our lives, right? Or we make choices in a way that are about self-regulating, but in a dysfunctional way, we can still use those choices to then judge ourselves as impaired, limited, insufficient, because it's the way we have chosen to adapt. And therefore we may tell ourselves, well, that's just who I am, right? That I'm a screw up. I'm insufficient. I can't do hard things. I'm not good at loving other people. I'm not sensitive to other people. And so we may then start telling ourselves again, these stories about who we are that we need those stories in a sense to organize our sense of self and our behavior, but they can be far too limited and therefore be really easy to keep reenacting and then reinforcing that story. So these self-concepts can feel built in to the reality of who we are when they are not, in fact, built in. They're powerful. Identity is powerful. And so how do we change it when it needs to change? Like, how do we evolve in our identities? The short answer is it always means stepping into uncertainty, stepping into behavior that we haven't yet mastered, and tolerating the disorganization to our sense of self, the disorientation to life that new behavior always requires. It means tolerating discomfort. That's always how the brain changes, is we subject it to situations that we have not yet mastered. I served as a missionary. And for those of you who have ever done something like that, where for me, I was in a foreign country trying to speak a foreign language. I remember being in an apartment that smelled of mildew. And I remember lying on this bed and seeing ants climb up the wall of the dank apartment in the sweltering heat of Spain. And I remember thinking, I will never live through this year and a half. Like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. And it was the hardest thing I'd ever done. I thought I was pretty good at learning language in the MTC until I got to Andalusia, and I could not understand anything, not anything. And feeling truly overwhelmed, that I was insufficient to the task. Well, I think about how much growth happened in that year and a half for me, because I was immersed in a setting that was asking far more of me than I yet had inside of me. And my brain was neuroplastic. I was learning to adapt to a new environment. If I had been home in a much more comfortable setting, that evolution would not have happened. And so, when we're young, it's actually a lot easier to put ourselves in situations that stretch us, disorient us. It's more a part of the developmental process that most of us are in, going to college, moving away from home, getting into a new relationship. As we get older, it gets easier to just move into kind of the routine, into things that no longer stretch us. It's easier to get away with not pushing ourselves outside of our comfort zone. And yet it limits our development. It limits what we can do and how we can grow. And so, I heard a story once that in the San Francisco Zoo, they had the animals in cages up to, I can't remember, the 1960s or something. And then at some point they wanted to put the animals in a more naturalistic setting. And so the elephants who had been in these cages, they removed them, and they were, there was a square of dirt that had been the cage itself, but now that it was removed and they were in an environment where they could move around, but these elephants wouldn't move off the pad of dirt. The cage was gone. There was nothing containing them except for their own fear, because they didn't know how to exist in the grass. They didn't know how to exist in an environment where they could walk around. So they, at least the way that this story is told, and assuming that it's true, they stayed basically where they had always been. And so, when an animal trainer, because animals are so limbic, and so are we, right, that the trainer is more like our prefrontal, and the limbic is always our fear. And so a stallion, for example, we at the Art of Loving retreat last year, we had a horse whisperer, a horse trainer come and show us how we work with our fears. And that is that we bring ourselves in a stepwise fashion into environments that we haven't yet mastered. And we choose into that new environment, and we learn to regulate ourselves in that new environment. We learn to calm down in it, habituate to it, get accustomed to it. We learn how to master that new environment. And, the new environment of not eating chocolate for me on day 3 was overwhelming my capacities. And so I'm like, Christy, give me this chocolate. Okay. I changed my mind. All right. So I'm not particularly impressed with my resolution there. But that is to say, you start getting signals like, this is uncomfortable. I don't want it. I want the familiarity. I want I want, you know, my body saying, where's the chocolate? So I'm going to just do what will make me more comfortable, but then pull me back to the behavior that I at least supposedly don't want. And that's what we're up against. And when, you know, when we're trying to change behavior, it's if our prefrontal can regulate us, can pull us into the environment while our limbic calms down, but doesn't try to take us way too far beyond maybe what we can handle. Now, we can handle a lot more than we think we can. I mean, I got through Spain, okay? And in the moment of the chocolate, this was just a passing, fleeting moment, but I just said, you know what? It's not, I changed my mind, okay? But, because it was easy to just do it. It was, the chocolate was right there, okay? I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. But the thing that a lot of us do is a lot of us are living in that prison or in that cage, just like the elephants. The door is wide open in our lives. We can walk out except for our anxiety, that it's challenging the self that we know for the self we can become. And so what we often do is we wallpaper our prisons and we try to get comfortable and we tell ourselves stories that we can't walk out, that no one will let us walk out, or we would walk out if somebody else would change. But it's really about the fact that we don't want the discomfort and the dysregulation of doing something different. And when we can understand that nothing's going wrong, that we're going to feel those feelings, that's in fact evidence that something's going right, and that staying in that experience just a little longer is going to help us change, right? That's often giving meaning to the discomfort can help us move through it. I remember one of the most helpful things somebody said to me once is that when you change your exercise pattern or your eating pattern. This was, I had been home with kids for 10 years. I hadn't exercised in 10 years. My eating habits weren't as good as I wanted them to be. And so I was making some changes, but it was all really uncomfortable for me. And something that I learned at that time was you basically only have to be uncomfortable for a couple of weeks. You know, I can't remember what it was, like 3 weeks. If you get through the 3 weeks, you start to actually on some level crave the exercise. Like on some level, you want it. And that was really helpful for me because I was like, I think I can do 3 weeks. I think I can basically push through the discomfort until I get to that feeling, because I had exercised earlier in my life and I knew that feeling. And so it was a way of giving meaning to the discomfort to get on the other side of it. Similar with food is once we habituate to a new palate, to a new way of eating, at first, it's really uncomfortable. It's like lettuce. It's so gross. It doesn't feel satisfying. My body can't handle it, blah, blah, blah. But if we can stay in the discomfort of whatever change we're trying to make, right, that and give meaning to that discomfort, then we can get on the other side of it and start to actually crave or like or want, even have what's the word I want to use? A gut biome that's actually lined up to digest that food and is going to make you want that healthier food. So that can help, that I'm not going to be uncomfortable forever, but it's a productive discomfort. Whenever we're stretching ourselves, it's going to be uncomfortable. Nothing is going wrong. And calming ourselves in the face of that discomfort is highly productive work. Now, a lot of times I watch people do more self-revealing, self-exposed action in their marriages. And it's hard because often it creates a reaction in their spouse. It's creating anxiety in them. I'm not somebody who speaks up honestly and my spouse is getting mad at me. And oh my gosh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm being selfish. Maybe, and then we want to pull back and take it back or paper over. And we interfere with the truth in the marriage that both of us need. And if instead we can say it's going to be uncomfortable to speak more truthfully or to love more wholeheartedly, in some way step outside of the comfort that I know, but if I can just hold on, soothe myself in the face of that anxiety and stay with it, change will happen. And so it's often that in those moments of discomfort that our soul is doing the most work, and leaning in is exactly what we need to experience the world and ourselves in a new way. right? Sometimes we just, the instincts to pull back, of course, but it keeps us in the old pattern, and leaning in is what allows us to find a new way of being in the world. So let me just give you some of my thoughts about what I see happening when people make meaningful change. And I don't have all the answers, of course. And I think that I'm hoping that the way that the psychology profession and the medical profession evolve is to have a better understanding of the mind-body connection, the way that they are deeply integrated. The tradition that I was trained up in is very much a talking therapy. It's working with meaning with people, and that matters. Talking to people about the meanings that they have made about their lives, about who they are, about their marriages, is powerful stuff. The prefrontal shapes deeply the choices that we make and why we make them. But I think it's also true that working with the body also shapes the mind. And that can be in terms of nutrition and health, but it can also be in helping people to settle the limbic system, to be able to get outside of their egos and to see things more truthfully and how they are. That oftentimes, you know, especially if there's been trauma and things like that, I can imagine that as we get better at working with our bodies, we can also better access our ability to evolve and grow beyond our lesser selves. So, so here's a few things that I think, and this is probably in the work I do, one of the most powerful things I believe is waking up to our self-deception, waking up to the limited stories we tell ourselves, because when we're in just, we're living it, we don't even know that it's a limited story. You know, I remember a client coming into me and she was telling me a story of her childhood, and it was so traumatic. Like so much abuse. She saw her mother be abused by her father. The mother had to go to the hospital one night. The father went to prison, and the policeman put her to bed. Okay. I don't know who else would have been in the house, maybe an older sibling or something, but she was just like a 6-year-old girl at the time. And so I referred to her family history as abusive or traumatic. I can't remember which word I used. And she was like, abusive? What do you mean? And I was like, what do you mean? What do I mean? like clearly, right? Clearly, like one of the worst stories I've ever heard. And, but see, her self-concept was not that she didn't yet have a self-concept that she had grown up in something that would be considered abusive. Right, that it was a normal for her. It was a normal way of thinking about what would happen in a family. And so she didn't yet have, she was just living that reality. She hadn't stepped aside to start to make sense of that reality, to start to understand that maybe I didn't just deserve that reality, that to see mom and dad in some ways as separate and how they related to her as separate that from the question of who she really was and what she was really capable of becoming. So we often just inherit those stories that we grew up with, right? How we think about ourselves, and we're telling ourselves on repeat many of the messages we received and heard, and don't realize that we're carrying that voice, that reflected sense of self with us, and it's determining us way more than it ought to often. And so if we come out of difficult childhood, getting more self-aware, getting more aware of making a distinction between how we were related to and who we are capable of being can be helpful. Just inserting that consciousness into it can help us be more careful about the stories we tell ourselves. But what I think, you know, is also true is waking up to our self-deceptions in the present as well. So especially in relationships, we often live in some degree of delusion about who we are, about how we shape our relationship, about how we impact our partner. And we often tell a story that is comfortable and congruent with our self-concept. And we don't see the negative impact it may have. And what we often do in our relationships is we exploit instinctively. We don't have to scheme in the back room. We just do it instinctively. The self-concept that our spouse wants, right? So, you know, I know that for my husband, he didn't want to think of himself as somebody who would interfere with my happiness. And because he didn't want to think of himself as telling me no on something, even if it wasn't good for us, right? Because I wanted it, that was hard for him to do. And I could just instinctively push on that, right? If I wanted something. And, you know, I had to wake up to the fact that I was being unfair, that I was taking advantage of a vulnerability in him. Now, we all can have these vulnerabilities. You're going to see the places where you struggle to do better, to love more open-heartedly, to let your spouse know how much they matter to you. If that's not easy for you, right, you're going to have a self-concept that justifies not doing that. You know, I'm just not that emotional. I just don't need that much affection. We tell ourselves something to make it okay. My spouse is really needy that way. They just tend to be insecure. And so we justify the pattern. Or if we have a hard time speaking honestly in the marriage, we might want to see ourselves as nice or see ourselves as somebody who doesn't cause disruption or think of ourselves as the mature one or something. And so we use that self-concept to limit the marriage and limit seeing ourselves and seeing the other truthfully to keep that limited story alive. So we can tell ourselves stories in our relationships. We also can tell ourselves stories just in our patterns of behavior. You know, I'm gonna start this new thing, whatever it is. I want to read my scriptures more. I want to do more. I want to reach out to my friends a little more. I want to exercise, whatever it is. And we think, you know what? I'll do that tomorrow. Tomorrow, I'm going to do it. Today, I'll make a list about tomorrow. Okay. Or we go out and buy all the new exercise equipment and we get everything because we are going to be a rock climber, whatever it is. And we've got all the things, but actually getting to the gym, right? Going out and doing the uncomfortable thing is a lot harder to do. And so a lot of times we're busy in the stage that feels comfortable, the hope stage, the planning stage, but actually moving into the uncertain action, that's much harder. And so what we do is we tell ourselves, well, I'm getting around to it, or I still need to get this other piece of equipment, then I'll go to the gym. Okay. We're just good at that stuff instead of just moving into action and letting the equipment follow. Okay. That is, you know, renting it or whatever. We're just getting out there and doing something new and then figuring out if we really like rock climbing enough to go and buy equipment, for example. Okay, so we're really good at doing that. And, you know, or we start out strong on the semester that we're in and maybe we're really good student for the first 2 weeks, but then we start telling yourself, you know what, I'm on top of this. I'm good. You know, I don't need to be that focused on it. I'll get back to it, to what is expected of me soon. And we start, you know, some people start strong, but then they start telling themselves stories that allows them to back off of the discipline and the focus that they had originally. So much of what I'm helping people do when I'm helping them change is helping them wake up to deeper truths about themselves, about their behavior pattern and the stories they've told themselves to keep those patterns alive and justified. Change always comes when those stories get unjustified by reality. And there's nothing like a partner to unjustify you. There's nothing like somebody that your limitations are affecting to unjustify you, or your own unhappiness to start unjustifying you. And when we come into a place of moral disgust, okay, that is, ugh, I do not like who I am. I cannot live with being this person. I'm not okay with the fact that I am hurting people when I do this, or that I'm hurting myself, or I'm hurting my future self. I can't do it anymore. That's when we change, when we can no longer tolerate the impact. This is why the Christmas Carol is such a powerful story. The ghost takes him to his past helps him better understand how he came into the hardened, self-justified present, seeing his actual effect on people by going to Christmas present and seeing how people actually experience him, seeing himself through their eyes, okay, which is kind of torturing because it's incongruent with the story he tells himself. These are foolish people off celebrating Christmas, and instead he sees loving good people who see him as he actually is, and he's looking at himself through their eyes, and he's having a disgust response to himself, like, please, please get me out of here. I don't want to be here. I don't want to see this anymore. And then the ghost of Christmas future comes and takes him into the future, that he has no friends, that his life accrues to nothing, nothing important. And it's so torturous to his ideals and to his own conscience that drives him to change. And that's really true. We don't want it to be that trauma changes us. I mean, trauma can change us in negative ways, but it can also be that traumatic experiences, some big rupture in the marriage, some big revelation in the marriage, something that comes to light that really is a crisis. That's really the word I want more than trauma. A crisis is often drives change because there's such a discrepancy between what we hold dear and what in reality, how we're behaving. We can't any longer escape the self-deception. And so that exposure opens us up for a change of heart, for the resolution that I have to become something better. My soul can no longer tolerate living as I'm doing this. And so we often try to protect ourselves and each other from the realities of who we are. We want to be nice. We don't want to cause turmoil. We don't want there to be conflict. We don't want to feel bad about ourselves. And so we are good at lying to ourselves. We even pray in ways that are not about self-revelation. They're about presenting, you know, help me have this and get that and hear this, that. But we're not really looking honestly at ourselves and our behavior. We're not letting those we love show us something about who we are because we don't want the disruption and the conscience of it, but we interfere with change. I really am convinced that things like sacrament and Sabbath and prayer are rituals designed to bring our consciousness to our behavior, to step out of our habitual repeating pattern. And so the reason we go to rote prayers is because we don't have to change anything. We don't have to be awake. We don't have to look. So we may say, well, we don't believe in rote prayers, but all of us do them, right? Those just routinized kind of saying the things, but not really getting at who am I and how am I impacting my life? And am I living in line with what I really believe to be good and true? And so that moral discrepancy can really drive us into new action. Now, a lot of us can use those moments to just go into shame. I'm worthless. Yeah, once again, I'm a big failure. I'm a big loser, you know. But we go into that toxic shame that I talk about in the Strengthening Your Relationship course. Instead of healthy shame that's helping us stay awake to ourselves, that's helping us bring our conscience into our daily behavior, it's a healthy kind of conscience. It's a healthy kind of awakeness. We can go from a shameless state, like we're out of touch with our impact, into a toxic shame. Okay, once again, I see that I'm the failure around here and I hate myself. And so we use that to kind of swing down into another kind of self-preoccupation, just a self-preoccupation of shame, but not into the more regulated place of I matter and I am flawed. That's the healthy place. I matter and I'm impacting those that I care about in ways that are not good. And it requires, again, truth and love go together. Healthy self-respect and healthy shame go together. They belong with one another. I matter, and I matter no more than anyone else. I'm a child of God, and I'm capable of doing things that hurt me and other people. And both are true. There's nothing I can do to alter my worth. And I am responsible for my impact. And so what am I going to do about it? And so that's what can lead us to the change of heart. It is in a really important way Like, to change is to believe in ourselves. To have a change of heart is to believe in ourselves. You know, sometimes when I'm working with people and somebody self-confronts and really is honest about who they have been, the negative impact that they've had on the marriage or on their own lives, and they're in a place of remorse, grief, loss of an identity that they knew, but they're waking up to something that is truer. It feels like they're losing something, you know, and in some ways it can be scary for people, but it's also paradoxically there's a birth of hope in the room. Like something real is starting to happen. This person believes in truth and love enough to sacrifice their ego and their control for it. So it's a deep act of love, actually, to get at what's true, even when what is true is disappointing. And so it's often when we can confront what is that we are most able to create a meaningful, intimate, more joyful life. Rather than I'm scrambling to prove I'm something, that I can accept what is and believe in my value enough to create something from a foundation of greater truth. You know, so a lot of times we will start out and try something new and our patterned response wants to kick in and we want to go back to the old pattern. And so when we do it, a lot of times we'll be like, you see, there I screwed up again. I'm never going to be right, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, how am I going to ever prove to you that I'm a good person? And we get really caught again in our self-disappointment and in how others might see us. And again, it's an act of faith to just forgive ourselves and begin again. Just begin again. I'm just going to go back and say, okay, I went back to the old pattern. What do I want? It's a self-defining process. Who do I desire to be? And today is a new day and I will begin again. And every time I begin and I step into that and I hold on to the discomfort of that process, I've still developed a new muscle. Even if it collapses, you know, at the fourth hour. But if I go back to it the next day and I hold on into the fifth hour, I'm still getting better at something. And this is not about proving to someone else we're changing. This is about bringing ourselves into a process over and over again because we want to build some new capacity within ourselves. And if we focus on what we don't get right, we lose track of what we are getting right. And we lose the clarity we need to keep going, to keep picking ourselves up, learning from the old pattern and moving back into the growth pattern again. So let me just see if there's any questions that have come in, Christy, or anything.
Yeah, someone had a follow-up. She said, I agree that crisis often drives change, sometimes big changes. However, I've seen and experienced that it's often difficult to sustain the changes over months or a year. How do we sustain the change?
You just have to come back to what it is I desire. Do I really desire it? Am I determined? You know, sometimes what happens in crisis is, okay, my spouse is really disappointed in me. I have to prove to them that I'm trustworthy. I have to prove to them that I'm good. I have to get them to forgive me. But the problem is that the locus of control is external. We're still in a validation pursuit. Rather than it's internal. It's not yet a change of heart that I want to be different. I want to do something better. That's when, you know, I've worked with people where, you know, they did something, they were unfaithful or something like that. And then they went through a process and they, you know, eventually got forgiveness by the church and whatever, got their spouse to forgive. But it actually wasn't really about a deep internal crisis with themselves. They were still trying to just get people to see them as good again. And, you know, I remember this one couple I worked with where that had been the case, kind of came back into good standing, but in short order, the problematic behaviors were still very much present. And they kept going on outside of the radar of his spouse. And then, you know, it basically all came into the present and it was evident. And he came into full crisis with himself. He could not live like this anymore. It had been torture for him for so long. And now he was losing everything. And at this point, you know, in the past, she was the one trying to get him to go to the bishop and trying to get him to do these things. She's like, I'm out. That I don't. You will do you, and I am going to do me at this point, and it's not going to be with you. And he understood that. But he, you know, was coming to me and saying, I have to become someone I can respect. And I may well lose the marriage, but I cannot lose myself too. I have to become a better person. And so he was taking himself to the bishop. He was taking himself to the experts that he needed to change, to evolve, to address his past, to address the pattern response, to become somebody that he could respect. And so a lot of times we have crises, but we don't use our crises to confront ourselves, to face who we are and to become better. We stay in a more superficial engagement, and then we need a lot of reminders, and we need a lot of, you know, we don't really need it. We are more in a pattern of trying to get something outside of us to push us into the uncertainty rather than our own conscience asking it of us. So now you may have a mini crisis and, you know, say, I really want to do that better, or I have a health crisis. Okay, I really need to kind of address it. But sometimes the less healthy we are, the bigger the crisis needs to be to create change. The more we can respond to our situation is often an indicator of our health, of our ability to invest in a better life without really having to lose a lot to do it. I don't know how to make somebody want something that they don't yet want other than revealing what the consequences are of continuing in that pattern so that they're making a more conscious choice. When I'm doing my job well, I'm not trying to get somebody to want something that they don't want. I'm just trying to show them who they are, what the impact is, and what may be the outcome of continuing in that pattern so that they can choose with the greatest amount of clarity possible, that I'm not participating in their self-deception. But we are agents and we get to choose. And so it's the self-deception that I'm trying to help people with so that they don't choose in a way that's unwise and that costs them too much. So I'm just going to go to this question that was written in. There's a couple of them I'll try and get to before we stop. This person says, my spouse is avoidant. So whenever we get into discussions about our relationship, she takes everything as a personal attack and internalizes any suggestion or feedback as a personal deficiency, no matter how benign it is or how nicely I try to frame it, which makes conversations challenging. And I have struggled to say what I feel and not be a nice guy because of my fear of her reactions. So one thing I would just say is just as a general response already is that we can care about our spouse's emotions, but we are not responsible for our spouse's emotions, right? This is, you know, where we sort of turn it into the smeller's the feller, okay? It's like the fact that you're bringing it up makes you the offender. And that's just not true. Okay, because if it's like, look, you know, you're hurting me by telling me I hurt you. That is nonsensical, even though many of us try to pull that off in our marriages. And so what we're basically saying is protect me from the reality of who I am and my impact. And when we want to see ourselves as a good person, somebody who doesn't get people upset or whatever, we will often hedge at speaking honestly about what it's like to live with our spouse or anybody else important in our life, because we don't want the reaction. Now, oftentimes people are having that precise reaction to get people around them to shut up. Okay. It's how they're trying to keep control over the story is I'm going to make it costly for you to speak what's real. And so it's not premeditated, but it's deliberate. If that makes sense, it's the anger and the reaction is a tool to get people to back off, and probably one that this person's spouse learned growing up, saw modeled growing up. Now, the person writing the question may well have seen modeled being a capitulator, an accommodator, a nice guy, being the one who, you know, just deals quietly, is the martyr, is the long sufferer. And yet it stabilizes dysfunction. It stabilizes a marriage not growing up. So remember, you can care about your spouse's feelings, but you're not responsible for their feelings. You're responsible for your actions. You're responsible for if they are hurtful, of course. But if you are trying to, it depends on what your desire is. If you're trying to actually help the marriage grow, it's going to require truth. It's going to require honesty. And the truth hurts, but it sets us free. Okay. The truth never hurt anyone. This is a loose Marcus Aurelius quote. Okay. The truth never hurt anyone. Okay. In fact, what hurts us is our deceptions and our self-deceptions. Now, if you're saying, you know, what I mean, sometimes people will use truth to basically stick it to somebody else. That's not what the person asking this question is doing. But I don't mean that you use, you know, quote unquote, truth statements to, you know, hurt other people's feelings. But if you're using what is true because you're trying to speak to something happening that needs to be addressed for the marriage to thrive or the relationship with your kids to do better or whatever the situation is, it's not going to feel good. I personally never have liked constructive feedback. It never feels good. Okay. But it's always the thing that makes me stronger and better. I'm always grateful retroactively. I just never like it in the moment. So this person says, I've gotten a lot better. And we are better at communicating and reconnecting after conflict than we were before. But there are still things we need to work on. And I get the impression that she feels because things are better than where we were when we hit rock bottom, that there's no reason to continue working on our relationship. And I would say, yeah, she's trying to get to the self that she knows, you know, basically keep things as she's known it by limiting how far these conversations go. And you are also, this person writing this, is also in some ways trying to manage his anxiety by hedging on how much truth is in the conversation. So yes, she is pressuring back, and that's not surprising. That makes her normal. Okay. So the person goes on to say, with that background, how does a spouse balance how hard to push when trying to help their spouse understand how their behavior impacts you? So it depends on how much you want the marriage to grow and how much dysregulation you can tolerate within yourself. Because I think you, the person writing the question, are as anxious as she is about your self-concepts and how much truth the marriage can bear. And so the question for you is, can you handle her dysregulation? Can you manage your dysregulation as she gets dysregulated around what is true? And true about you, true about your experience. And I talk about this a lot in the Strengthening Your Relationship course, of how to have these conversations in the most constructive way possible, right? And it has to do with laying out the data, the behavioral data that have led you to the conclusion or the meanings that are alive in you in the relationship, because it allows your spouse to actually see themselves, see you through the data, to see how you got to your conclusion. Now, they may not agree with your conclusion, but at least it helps them understand, how did you get to that? Why do you see me in that way? What is your actual experience? And they are free to sort out their own conclusion about those data, but it's helping them to see things that they are otherwise going to be blind to, and to accommodate that picture into their own thinking about what is real and who they are and what may need to change in them. It's very, very important to growing up. I mean, it's often been when I've seen things about myself through my kids' eyes, through my husband's eyes, through a sibling's eyes, that I'm like, oh, yeah, that's, I don't like that about myself. And that's what's driven the change, is that conscience, that disgust. Like, that's not what I want to be. That's not who I want to be. And so it is a gift to see ourselves truthfully through another's experience of us. But it does take, if you're going to be the one who's sharing the picture, to somebody who really doesn't want to hear it, it's going to be anxiety evoking for the speaker. And handling yourself in that is very, very important for the growth of the marriage, not to mention your own soul and your own differentiation. So how do you do that without becoming dysregulated yourself? I find it difficult to stand my ground and hold her accountable for her actions versus what she says she meant or was going to do, you know, versus, you know, coming across it. Meaning, I think what this person's wife is doing is talking about, oh, I didn't intend that. That's not what I really meant. You're getting it wrong. And that's a very typical response. That's often what we do. Well, you know, this is the reality. The way I see it is the reality, right? And so what it means is staying anchored ourselves. How do we do that? One way we do that is by holding on to the fact that what we're doing is necessary for the relationship to get better. Now, you have to make sure that that's true, okay? That you are clear about what you're actually aiming towards. If you're just there to justify ourselves or to say, I'm right and you're wrong and you don't get it, okay, well, that intention is going to come across and is going to dysregulate both of you. But if you're really truly trying to create something better, holding on to that fact helps a lot. I mean, in my work with couples, it was often hard, still can be hard for me sometimes, to say things that need to be said that I know we're going to upset people. And I don't like upsetting people. And the thing that's probably helped me most is just, first of all, watching people evolve when I tell them things that are hard to hear, but also just holding on to that. I care about them being able to run their lives better, to have a better relationship, to not be so trapped by their self-deception. And so it makes it easier because, you know, we'll submit to hard things when we believe it's going to make us better. If we have cancer and someone's going to remove a tumor, we're going to submit ourselves to being cut open, but we do it willingly because we trust that person is there to make something better. And so we do hard things when we map the intention of the other person is to actually make the situation better than it is. And so often leading with that, I want a better marriage with you. I hate saying these things to you. I know you hate it. There's nothing fun about this. I remember somebody saying to me, I don't like what you're saying to me or something like that. And I was like, I don't like saying it. Okay, it's not that this is fun, but it matters. And so saying I want a better marriage, it's why I want to keep talking to you about how I experience. You may well have your clarity about your intentions and your motivations, but can you listen to me explain my experience of your behavior and what it means to me? Now, if you're talking to somebody, they keep talking over you, I suggest that you keep talking slowly and keep calming yourself down, but stay in the conversation. The calmer person has more control in the conversation, right? Has more authority in the conversation. And so if you can stay in it and keep regulating yourself, it's powerful. Okay. Now, the goal is not to overpower. It's to be intimate. It's to regulate yourself in the face of the dysregulation. And it's not easy, but it is the growth of being in relationship in a truthful and loving way. That's what it asks of us often. Okay, the person just goes on to say, I desperately want to believe what she says, but her behavior is never aligned with what she says. It feels like she says the right things to make me feel better. Yes, and she's pushing on the part of you that just wants it to go away too. And then she'll do a few things, but the change is always temporary, which means it's superficial. It's about accommodating you a little bit and then going back to how things are. It's like she's trickling me along just enough. Yes. Many of us do this, just give enough to get them off my back, to believe something's going to change or something's going to be a little different, but it's not really addressing the issue. It's not really about a change of heart. So during the conversations, it feels like I have to be so direct and almost a jerk in order to constantly pull her back in by saying something like, I understand that's what you are saying, but there's no evidence from your actions to support that you really prioritize that or want to do that. I think that's okay to say that. And you want to basically say, like, look, I'm not the definer of truth. It's not me and God talking right now. It's me saying my honest experience is that your actions don't support the story you're telling for me. I don't see it. And, you know, I'm willing to have you prove me wrong if it's there's something that I'm missing here. But that's how I am experiencing you. Here are the data. And so this is the meaning I give to it. And it's not about demanding that your story prevails, but it is about holding on to the truth of your experience in front of your spouse, even if they don't like it. If it's truthful and it's defined by the desire to create better, it's okay to settle down about it. Okay. Because we can't drive evolution in our lives through validation. It doesn't happen. It certainly doesn't happen as an adult, and it certainly doesn't happen in marriage. Usually if conflict is coming up against the invalidations that drive our deeper integration of what's true and help us to grow. So it might be helpful for the person asking this question to consider, what is the self-concept that's keeping me stuck? You know, what is the idea about myself that I want to have or that I want my spouse to have that throws me off in the face of her anger or when she's trying to sell the story that, you know, she's really changing? Is there something that it's pushing on in me that makes it harder for me to steady myself? And what is that? And is that a place that I need to grow myself up a bit and not be so dependent on approval to anchor more into what is my most honest experience so that we can have more truthful conversations? Truth is what drives drives growth first and foremost and drives us into that crisis with ourselves that we need to make meaningful change, to have a change of heart, to say, I want to do better. And I really think that's what marriage is designed to do. You know, in my book, That We Might Have Joy, that's really the main theme, is that if we want to grow in our ability to be in an intimate relationship, we have to go through the process of waking up to ourselves and using the self-authoring part of us to choose more truthfully and more lovingly. That's how we grow. It's how we grow into a deeper peace with ourselves and with the person we're with. Okay. That is it for tonight. I thought tonight was going to be shorter, but alas, we are at an hour. So
speaking of your book,
yes,
on February 6th, you'll be in Salt Lake City signing books.
That's right.
I just realized we didn't talk about that.
Yes. So February 6th, what's the name of the bookstore again, Christy?
It's Weller Bookworks. It's in Trolley Square.
Okay. Yeah. So I will be there Friday night. Is that right?
Friday night from 6 to 7:30 in Salt Lake City, February 6th. Yes.
Yeah. So come see me, come say hello. We will, of course, have lots of books there. If you have a book already, just come say hello to me. Let me sign your book. If you haven't gotten one yet, come and buy one. Or if you've read it and you know that you loved it and you want to give it to your friends, come get it. Also, it will be before Valentine's Day, so it's a great Valentine's Day gift. All right. Thanks, everybody. And I will see you next month.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.